deadlines. Iran urges the interim Afghan government to protect the security of citizens in reaction to the bloody attack targeting an educational center in Kabul. President Vladimir Putin signs decrees paving the way for four Ukrainian regions to join Russia. Also coming up, Nicaragua escalates a diplomatic standoff with Western countries, this time severing its relations with the Netherlands. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran has condemned the Friday terrorist attack in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, that killed nearly two dozen people and injured many more. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani described the attack as a heinous crime, saying it was against religious teachings and basic human rights, or human principles, I should say. He added the bloodshed rests on the shoulders of its perpetrators and those backing terrorists. Kanani expressed condolences to the bereaved families. He reminded the Taliban government in Afghanistan about its responsibility to provide security for citizens. The blast ripped through an educational center in an area mainly populated by the Shia Hazara community. Many of those killed were teenagers who were getting extra tuition in preparation for university entrance exams. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree for the formal accession of four Ukrainian regions of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk and Luhansk. In a speech at the Kremlin, Putin said people in the four regions have become Russian citizens forever. More in this report.
For many years, the people of Donbas have been waiting for this historic day, which was preceded by a bloody war in the east of Ukraine that led to the intervention of the Russian army to save the Lugansk and Donetsk people from genocide. Despite Western pressure, the Russian president did not hesitate to accept the request of four regions of eastern Ukraine to join the federation through a referendum described as successful by authorities in those regions. Central Election Committee representatives reported that those who took part in the votes decided overwhelmingly in favor of the accession to Russia.
The unbroken people of Donbas, Zaporizhia and Kherson said the word. I want the authorities in Kyiv and the real masters in the West to hear me, and I want everyone to remember this. People living in DPR, LPR, Kherson and Zaporizhia have become our citizens forever.
In a ceremony attended by the heads of Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson and Zaporozhye regions, Vladimir Putin signed a decree for the formal accession of the former Ukrainian territories controlled by the Russian army over the past months. As a result, the four regions became part of the Russian Federation, which is now obliged to protect them from any aggression under the constitution and the Russian military doctrine.
Today we are fighting for a just and free path. First of all, for ourselves, for Russia, for diktat, despotism to remain forever in the past. I am convinced that countries and peoples understand that a policy based on exclusivity of anyone, on the suppression of other cultures and peoples, is inherently criminal, that we must turn this shameful page. The collapse of Western hegemony that has begun is irreversible. And I repeat again, it will not be the same as before.
Our country is taking back its historical lands that our grandfathers defended. I am inspired that I caught and I am a participant of this moment. These territories and our people were artificially divided.
The West, led by the United States, has been supplying all kinds of weapons to Ukraine, sending large numbers of mercenaries to the country, and imposing huge economic sanctions against Russia. But it has failed to stop Moscow's special military operation in Ukraine. And for the Donbas, Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, which have been fighting for their right to become part of Russia, the accession means, first of all, security and sustainable economic development for them.
The right and decision of the four regions to join Russia is undoubtedly a historical moment. Moscow says strikes by Ukraine on those territories joining Russia today will be seen as an act of aggression against the state. It has vowed to protect the territories at all cost after their accession to Russia. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Let's return to our earlier story regarding Iran's condemnation of the terrorist attack in Afghanistan that targeted the country's Shia Hazara community, and bring in Sayed Zafar Mehdi, a journalist from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Sayed Zafar, welcome. And as we are speaking, there are reports reaching us here at Press TV that the death toll from that attack has risen to 35. Does the Taliban have the capability, firstly, to defeat terrorist groups and bring security to Afghanistan?
Salam, thank you for having me. The scenes unfolding in Kabul are truly heartbreaking. You know, at times it becomes difficult to process so much grief and pain. You know, this persecuted community of Hazara Shias in Afghanistan has given so much blood over the years. Too many martyrs, you know, it continues. Unfortunately, you know, as you can see, there are no hashtags for them. No condemnation, no press marches, no candlelight vigils, no probes. And this cycle of violence, this unending cycle of violence targeting them has somehow been normalized over the years. And this is a country that has never seen peace. You know, if you go back in history, it was British, then it was Soviets. Then it was Americans and their allies, and now it's Daesh. Daesh is, of course, a proxy of Western powers that has filled this vacuum left by U.S.-led NATO forces. I see blood of these innocents killed in yesterday's attack in this predominantly Shia neighborhood of Dasht-e-Bashti in Western Kabul in the hands of Americans. You know, they are responsible for this mess, for the rise and resurgence of this terrorist group. You know, since 2014, when this Daesh terrorist group made first inroads in the country, they have been relentlessly bombing mosques, schools, hospitals, you know, that belong to this community. Dasht-e-Bashti and other smaller pockets which are inhabited by Shias in Kabul have been the main targets. I myself have survived at least two such attacks when I was stationed in Kabul as a journalist some years ago. You know, there are basically three main reasons for this horror unleashed by this group on this persecuted, vulnerable community. One of them is this avenging the defeat in Syria to the resistance axis, which includes Hazara-led Fatimi Brigade. Second is to wipe out the Hazara Shias, who are deemed as heretics by these Daesh ideologues. Right. And thirdly, to stoke the flames of sectarianism in Afghanistan, where the divide has historically been on tribal and ethnic lines, not sectarian lines.
Right.
And, when it comes to Taliban has, if you go back in history to sort of late 1890s, it was a notorious Pashtun ruler. His name was Abdul Rahman Khan. He committed genocide against Hazara Shias. And this savagery later on continued under other Pashtun leaders and terrorist groups, which included Hazara, Taliban in the earlier years, you know. But in recent years, Taliban has refused to claim responsibility for any such attack.
Okay.
And its approach, has surely changed.
Right. And then just pardon me, because we're running out of time, how much has the United States failed Afghanistan and its security? And then when it comes to Daesh, there's always been said that you can defeat Daesh, terrorist groups such as Daesh, defeat the territory that it gains, but you have to go after the ideology. The United States didn't go after the ideology of these terrorist groups in its so-called war on terror. Instead, it went and invaded Afghanistan and Iraq and sprung that ideology even further, expanded it.
Exactly. See, if you look at the genesis of this group, if you look at how their rise and resurgence, I see a direct hand of involvement of Western powers, you know, and it has always acted as a proxy for the Western powers. When it rose in 2014, its job was basically to sort of be a counterweight to Taliban. It was fighting the Taliban group in mostly eastern provinces, for example, Nangarhar. It was fighting Taliban that time, and the other job was to sort of attack these vulnerable ethnic minorities. And after this, Taliban made a comeback last year in August 2021. their job became more, you know, sort of wider. And now the job is basically to destabilize Afghanistan, to create sectarian tensions and sort of other goals which are common with Western powers. Daesh is a formidable group, you know, and supporting it has become more important for Western powers now, you know, after they faced disgraceful defeat at the hands of Taliban last year. And having said that, it's the responsibility of the de facto government in Kabul, the Taliban government, to ensure safety and security of all ethnic minorities. And that is where I think the need for an inclusive and broad-based government with the representation of all ethnic groups comes into play. That would be a good beginning to decimate this Taliban terrorist, Daesh terrorist group, as well as the ideology that guides it. You know,
right.
And
so you're, yeah, right. So you're saying that that would be a statement of intent by the Taliban to have an inclusive government. Sayed Zafar Mehdi, I'm afraid we have run out of time. Thank you very much. It is the breaking news reaching us is that the death toll has risen to 35. It is unfortunate that Muslims are the biggest victims of terrorism, something never mentioned in the Western mainstream media. Moving on, British commuters are facing travel chaos as tens of thousands of railway workers go on strike in disputes over pay and job security. This is the largest one-day rail strike in decades, involving three major trade unions and more than 50,000 workers across the country. Officials say only around 11% of train services will operate on Saturday. In some parts, there will be no trains at all. The strike will also hamper travel to the ruling Conservative Party's annual conference in Birmingham, due to begin tomorrow. The industrial action is the latest in UK strikes this year. Workers across different sectors are unhappy with the rising cost of living outpacing pay rises. Dozens of protests organised by a campaign called Enough is Enough have already taken place too. The strikes are also backed by the opposition Labour Party's lawmakers. To Nicaragua, which has broken off diplomatic relations with the Netherlands over what it calls Amsterdam's interventionist policies. Nicaragua says the Netherlands has repeatedly meddled in its affairs, accusing it of adopting a neo-colonialist stance. It is also critical of the Netherlands for refusing to fund a long-promised hospital. Meanwhile, Nicaragua says it would deny the new U.S. ambassador entry over what it called his interfering attitude and disrespectful remarks. The U.S. Senate just confirmed Hugo Rodriguez's appointment on Thursday. He had described Nicaragua as a pariah state and branded Daniel Ortega's government a dictatorship. In another development, Nicaragua on Wednesday asked the EU ambassador to leave its soil without giving any reasons. Palestinian resistance groups have warned the Israeli regime against any attempt to target their senior members. The group said Tel Aviv should be awaiting a tough military response if it carries out its threat to assassinate Palestinian commanders. They said Israeli troops will face death if they attack the Jenin refugee camp north of the occupied West Bank. Jenin has been the focal point of an Israeli crackdown against Palestinians in recent months. The Palestinian groups also warned that Israeli troops will die both inside their armored vehicles and on the streets as a result of heavy fire by resistance groups. The warning comes after Chief of the General Staff of the Israeli military, Aviv Kochavi, threatened to assassinate senior Palestinian commanders. Let's bring in Mona Kandil from Occupied Ramallah, our correspondent there. Mona, what more can you tell us about the warnings by the resistance against the apartheid terrorist Israeli regime?
Well, military wings of Palestinian factions in the occupied West Bank and mainly in Jenin held a press conference, let's say, and warned the Israeli regime from the move of trying to assassinate leaders of Palestinian armed groups as the threats that have came, as you have mentioned, Israel. It seems that it gave a green light for assassination drones in the occupied West Bank. Israeli military chief Kochavi said that the Israeli military would be gave a green light for assassinating the leaders of the armed groups. The Israeli regime is completely refusing any move by the Palestinian armed groups or by the Palestinian resistance movement or any kind of Palestinian activities in the occupied West Bank. They want to prevent any action of activities, any form of resistance against the Israeli forces and the Israeli soldiers. And from here, the Israeli troops continue to raid Palestinian areas on a daily basis. Confrontations take place between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers. And at the end of the day, let's say at least every week, a number of Palestinians are being killed. Those whom the Israelis claim they are wanted for security reasons. At the end of the day, those are Palestinians engaged in different forms of resistance. They are members of the different Palestinian, Palestinian resistance groups. But the move and the thing that is dangerous now, the Israelis might not be going to confrontations or clashes. They are choosing the easy way. The easy way for the Israeli soldiers is to assassinate the leaders and activists of the Palestinian resistance groups in the occupied West Bank, of course.
Let's see how events unfold in Jenin, the birthplace of the West Bank resistance. Mona, thank you very much indeed for that. Mona Kandil there, our correspondent, joining us from occupied Ramallah. To Iran now, where the country's intelligence ministry says 9 foreign nationals have been arrested for their role in recent riots in the country. The ministry says the detainees are from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, and other countries. It said they were either present in the riots or plotting behind the scenes. The ministry said the US and the UK were directly involved in stirring up the unrest. It added that scores of MKO terrorists, as well as mercenaries belonging to Zionist groups, were also detained. The ministry noted that 36 kilograms of explosives were also seized from Takfiri terrorist groups planning to exploit the unrest and detonate to them in public areas. The riots in Iran broke out after the death of a woman in hospital days after she collapsed at a police station. Iran's police have dismissed allegations of physical violence against 22-year-old Mahsa Amini. Brings an end to the World Bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Liz Truss and Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng on Friday, 30th of September, refused to bow to demands to publish an early forecast of government growth plans and the impact of planned tax cuts, which have led to turmoil in the financial markets. Stay with us for the world media's coverage of this story. Britain's Guardian newspaper tells us more. Britain's Prime Minister Liz Truss and Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng have refused to release independent analysis of their tax plans until more than 6 weeks after receiving them, despite more calls from Tory MPs for Downing Street to reassure the markets. The Prime Minister and Chancellor of the Exchequer said they would only publish the independent forecasts on 23rd of November, alongside a fiscal statement, despite them being ready on 7th of October. Several Conservative MPs have already urged Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng to allow the Office for Budget Responsibility, the OBR, Britain's independent fiscal watchdog, to reveal its forecast as soon as possible, including Conservative MP Mel Stride, the chair of the Treasury Committee. Peter Alders, another Tory MP, said on Friday that the fiscal plan with new rules should be brought forward. Writing for the House of Commons magazine, he said, "Time is running out to show the British people that the Conservative Party deserves to retain the honour of serving as their government." Another Tory MP, Charles Walker, conceded the party had lost the next election and said the government had a duty to the country to get the public finances in the best possible shape before it is lost. However, Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng do not appear to be bowing to pressure from their own party. The pair met the chair of the Office of Budget Responsibility, Richard Hughes, on Friday, 30th of September, after a week of turmoil in the financial markets, in response to Kwasi Kwarteng's mini-budget promising tax cuts funded by borrowing, without any accompanying independent growth forecasts. After the mini-budget, the British pound plunged, mortgage rates soared, and the Bank of England had to stage an emergency £65 billion intervention to bail out pension funds. The Treasury has been facing calls from its select committee to allow the Office of Budget Responsibility to release forecasts earlier to reassure the financial markets, to reassure the public and the parliament that the government's plan will lead to higher growth. However, Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng appear to be holding firm against that idea. The pound, which hit a one-week high at 1.1235 for US dollar at 10 a.m. on Friday, has dipped back into negative territory against the dollar. It is currently trading 0.1% lower at $1.11. The Treasury said Liz Truss, Kwasi Kwarteng and Richard Hughes had discussed the process for the upcoming economic and fiscal forecast, which will be published on 23rd of November, and the economic and fiscal outlook. They agreed, as is usual, to work closely together throughout the forecast process and beyond, it said. The Prime Minister and Chancellor reaffirmed their commitment to the independent Office of Budget Responsibility and made clear that they value its scrutiny. Following the meeting, the Office of Budget Responsibility confirmed its forecast would be ready to deliver to the Chancellor on 7th of October and would, as always, be based on our independent judgment about economic and fiscal prospects and the impact of the government's policies. In a statement after the meeting, which appears to last less than 50 minutes, the Office of Budget Responsibility said, "We discussed the economic and fiscal outlook and the forecasts we are preparing for the Chancellor's medium-term fiscal plan." In interviews on Friday, Liz Truss showed no sign of rowing back from the controversial mini-budget She also insisted there could have been a full forecast produced by the Office of Budget Responsibility in time for last week's fiscal event, even though the Public Finance Watchdog said it had prepared interim figures that were ready to be published. In that timescale, there couldn't be a full Office of Budget Responsibility forecast, but we are committed to the Office of Budget Responsibility forecast, she said. We're working together with the OBR. There will be an event on 23rd of November where the policies are fully analysed by the Office of Budget Responsibility. The Reuters news agency tells us more about the same story. British Prime Minister Liz Truss and Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng on Friday refused to bow to demands to publish an early forecast of government growth plans and impact of planned tax cuts, which have led to turmoil in the financial markets. Kwasi Kwarteng unveiled a string of lower taxes last week that were unusually not accompanied by forecasts from the Office for Budget Responsibility. A resulting sell-off led to the Bank of England to intervene with emergency bond buying to protect pension funds from partial collapse. Kwasi Kwarteng has come under pressure to allay market fears and bring forward a fiscal statement planned for 23rd of November, when he has said he would publish the Office of Budget Responsibility forecasts and detail the costs of the debt finance tax cuts, along with a path to lower debt in the medium term. However, after Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng met the Office of Budget Responsibility's chair, Richard Hughes, on Friday, the finance ministry said the timing of Kwarteng's medium-term fiscal plan was unchanged. They discussed the process for the upcoming economic and fiscal forecast, which will be published on 23rd of November, and the economic and fiscal outlook, the Treasury confirmed in a statement. They agreed, as usual, to work closely together throughout the forecast process. The Office of Budget Responsibility said the first draft will be delivered to Kwasi Kwarteng on 7th of October, and it would, as always, be based on our independent judgment about economic and fiscal prospects and the impact of government's policies. The watchdog had said on Thursday it had offered to produce an analysis for Kwasi Kwarteng's tax-cutting plan, but were not commissioned to do so. A senior parliamentary committee has joined those urging Kwasi Kwarteng to bring forward his November statement to calm financial markets, echoing calls from other lawmakers in the ruling Conservative Party. Andrew Griffith, the minister who oversees the City of London financial district, earlier said the projections should not be rushed. We all want the forecast to be done as quickly as possible, as the Office of Budget Responsibility can, but also you also want them to have the right level of detail. Liz Truss, who only replaced Boris Johnson as Prime Minister this month, has argued that the market turbulence is a result of global problems caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and that she will stick to her plans to snap the economy out of years of stagnant growth. Liz Truss also says the government had to intervene to provide support to help people and businesses with their energy bills, a package that the government said would cost about £60 billion for the next 6 months in order to keep a typical British household's bill to under £2,500 a year. Official data showed on Friday that Britain's economy grew in the second quarter, but was still below its pre-pandemic peak. Critics have said Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng should have included forecasts from the Office of Budget Responsibility to reassure financial markets about where the funding would come from before announcing their proposed £45 billion tax cuts.
This one lay.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight, a turning point in the months-long war between Russia and Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed the treaties on the accession of four Ukrainian regions. This follows referendums recently held in Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk, where people voted overwhelmingly to join Russia, a vote as expected not recognized by Ukraine and its Western allies. Kiev was quick to respond to Moscow's proclamation by announcing its application for accelerated membership in the Western Military Alliance, NATO. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss what this move means for the Russia-Ukraine conflict and how it affects the growing tensions between Moscow and the West. Joining us on tonight's show, we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade. And contributor at the Schiller Institute, Carol Varekin, joining us from the French capital, Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. Russia says that people in the four regions have voted overwhelmingly to join the Russian Federation. Ukraine and its Western allies, including the EU and the U.S., have called the referendums illegal and a sham. I want you to give us your perspective on the referendums and their ratifications by Moscow.
Well, first of all, this is just effectively a fait accompli. The accession of these territories to the Russian Federation was achieved by military means, but the important thing is that the people in those regions are fully in support of joining Russia and becoming members and citizens of Russia. The condemnation from the West is typical because they speak one thing and do another. If we talk about the United States itself, the entire country of the United States was stolen from its original inhabitants, and referenda were never used to take over territory. They simply stole it or took it by force of arms. And for the United States to be condemning Russia's efforts to involve the people in each of these decisions is simply not believable and not credible.
Let's cross over to our guest in Paris, Mr. Varekin. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described Russia's incorporation of the territories as a, quote, dangerous escalation and an illegal violation of the UN Charter. Talk to us about the legality of the move and also touch up on the issue, as our guest in Belgrade did, as to why these regions have voted in favor of joining Russia so overwhelmingly.
Well, the Western narrative is increasingly Orwellian, and where peace is war and the world is upside down, because the nuance, the differentiation, which is really has to be made, is the difference between international order based on rules written exclusively by the West, and then on the other side, the international law as it was defined by the Charter of both the Atlantic Charter in 1941 and by the United Nations, which includes the self-determination of people to know where what what kind of self-governance they want. So since this war has started in 2014, and that people in Kiev have been denying not only the Russian speakers but also the Hungarian speakers to use their own language to manage their affairs, many of these Russian-speaking people in southern and eastern Ukraine, of course, felt like kicked out of their own country and are fully quite happy that they can be part of the Russian Federation. What I am really shocked with is the fact that there is apparently there were a kind at least over 100 of observers from foreign countries, including from South Africa, France, and other countries. And these observers, nobody is interviewing them. I got a report from a French observer who said it was just normal, and that contrary to that Mr. Blinken was saying, this is not on gunpoint people pushed to vote. These are people happy to vote and finally relieved that they can now think about a better future.
John Voznich, what does this accession by Russia mean overall for the conflict itself? How will this change the situation on the ground, in your opinion?
Oh, this is, in fact, a night and day change in the situation. Now that these territories have declared for membership in the Russian Federation and the president has signed a decree accepting their application, once the legal formalities are completed and the state declarations are circulated, then any attack by Ukrainian forces on these territories constitutes, at least in the eyes of Russia and its allies and the many other countries around the world that recognize the procedure of referenda, it constitutes an act of war against Russia proper. This could explain why President Putin called up so many reservists, because if Ukraine wants to attack Russia, then Russia will, of course, have to defend itself. And the result of Russia itself having to defend itself against Ukraine will mean a totally new phase in the war and could bring down the entire Ukraine regime in Kiev. That's really playing with fire. But of course, the decision is not being made by the marionette president that the United States put in power there, Mr. Zelensky, but it is being made in NATO headquarters, where they're trying to gauge how much further they can push this conflict, how many more weapons they can circulate, and how much more they can dominate the European allies of America ever since World War II. This is really a turning point where we see whether NATO cracks or whether NATO continues to oppress the entire region. This is the day.
Mr. Varykhan, Ukraine says now that it's applying for fast-track NATO membership following Moscow's formal integration of those four Ukrainian regions into Russia. I want to get your thoughts on this issue itself, whether it will be heeded by NATO at this point, and what kind of a response also are you expecting to see from the likes of the U.S. and the EU and possibly the United Nations?
Well, I just watched the press conference of Mr. Stoltenberg in Brussels, and the most scary thing about this whole press conference is that he qualified the integration of these four regions as the most serious escalations since the beginning of the conflict. So instead of learning the lesson that this war is unwinnable and that the West should stop using the Ukrainians as cannon fodder, they keep insisting that this is all that the Russians are the aggressor and that we cannot sign peace and that we will. The West is supposed to fight till to liberate these four regions, including Crimea, which is a special case and which is even, most any professional diplomat would take out the Crimea issue out of a current ceasefire negotiation because it's a very complicated issue. So the most scary thing is on the one side the blind attitude of NATO, and I would say on the other side the new element, which has been the sabotage of the gas pipelines close to Denmark.
John Bosnich, I want you to address that issue as well in terms of responses. U.S. President Joe Biden said Washington will never recognize what he called Russia's annexation of Ukrainian land. The European Union has vowed to never recognize the absorption, accused the Kremlin of jeopardizing global security. Give us your thoughts on the reactions and responses that we'll be seeing from NATO countries, from the United States, maybe even the UN.
Well, when a political leader says they will never recognize an act, that's a diplomatic code for impotence. It means that we can't do anything about it. We realize that we can't reverse it. But at least on paper, we're going to say we don't recognize it. This is effectively a day of victory for Russia. And I would also dispute Mr. Stoltenberg's comment about this being a critical increase in the crisis. In fact, what has happened here is the crisis is winding down, because Russia has declared the inclusion of these territories into Russia proper. And this means that NATO now has to make a choice which they simply don't have the guts to make, which is to make war on Russia proper. They thought that they could twist arms. They thought that they could continue to pull strings and continue to do what they do best. Because what NATO does best is not fight wars, but sell weapons. Mr. Stoltenberg is probably on a percentage cut for weapons sales, and that's where he makes his money. And that's the same with many of the leaders in the NATO countries. Their job is to sell weapons, to sell fear, and to get their taxpayers to continue dishing out to a military-industrial complex that not only runs the wars, but it bribes the politicians and runs the Western world. This conflict in Ukraine is not just a turning point locally in Ukraine. It's a global turning point that the world is saying, not just Russia, but the world is saying, don't do it anymore. We've had enough. And that is significantly visible when you see that the entire rest of the world, the countries that are not military colonies of the United States inside NATO, the entire rest of the world is united against this NATO incursion into the back doorstep of Russia.
Mr. Varikhan, in recent days, multiple gas leaks have been discovered in the Nord Stream pipelines running from Russia to Europe. Vladimir Putin earlier accused the U.S. and its allies of sabotaging the pipelines. He said, quote, "The sanctions were not enough for the Anglo-Saxons, so they moved on to sabotage," and he added, "It's clear to everyone who benefits from this." Who will benefit from such a scenario?
Well, of course, the first benefiter will be some of the Polish stooges, because they have created this new Baltic pipeline to get gas from Norway into Europe. So we should, of course, investigation will have to bring up new elements, but it is, this thing is really incredible, because first of all, the Baltic Sea is completely controlled by NATO. There were recent maneuvers, including on underwater drones, and even if they recognize that this was done by the Russians, it would be, a total failure. Secondly, there were all the warnings from Mike Pompeo to Condoleezza Rice to Biden himself on February 7, where he said they would never tolerate that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline would exist, because it would create a more integrated cooperation between Germany and Russia. Now the big Russia is losing. And maybe the pipelines will be definitely become unusable, because the seawater creates a lot of corrosion inside the pipes, and it will be very hard to repair them. But in this way, many people in Eastern Europe, in the Czech Republic, There were huge demonstrations in favor, trying to push the governments of Germany and others to open the Nord Stream pipelines and to come to a kind of deal and work out outside or get rid of the sanctions, because the winter is here arriving in Europe and many people don't want to freeze. We want peace. We want to settle this question in a rational manner. And the big winner, the big loser in any case is Europe. And that's the new game changer, because if the United States and the forces behind NATO or the military industrial complex, if they start attacking the infrastructure inside the European Union, this is an entire new dimension of this global war.
John Bozich, Russia has time and again said countries supplying weapons to Ukraine and training its soldiers were in fact parties to the conflict. The question is, will this support ultimately result in this conflict spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger?
That's always a possibility if the conflict gets out of control. But it is not in the interest of any of the parties, including Ukraine, except perhaps for the joker president whose stay in power depends on the war continuing. What we've got here is a lateral expansion of the war into European territory. The attack on the pipeline, most likely done by England or America because they have the tools and the capacity to do it, is actually a militarized attack on the EU by non-EU members, England and America. Now, yes, the leaders of the EU are largely puppets of America and of England, and these puppets will not object. But the citizens of Europe should at some point be raising their heads up and saying, why are we putting up with this? Why are we continuing to elect leaders who do whatever they're ordered to do from Washington? So I would suggest that although there is a temporary setback in terms of cooperation between Russia and Germany, which is inevitable, that they will cooperate in the future, the temporary setback is pointing the finger at England and the United States, thereby distancing the people of Germany and the people of Europe from the Anglo-American Empire, which, if anything results from this war, the best thing that could result is that Europe becomes an independent territory again, no longer under Anglo-American foreign control.
Over to our guest in Paris, we're talking about the support that the United States and NATO has been giving to Ukraine. Is this support ultimately what the U.S. and NATO wants is the conflict to be prolonged and to see it dragged out for as long as possible in hopes that it weakens Russia? I want to get your perspective on that and whether they've been successful, in your opinion.
Well, at the press conference, Mr. Stoltenberg, because the question was asked by a Ukrainian journalist if they would get the right for a fast track to enter into NATO, and Mr. Stoltenberg was very evasive and not saying that this the doors are still open, but right now the issue is, as you say, just to give the means to Ukraine to defend its and to reconquer its territory. Now, on the ground, there were recent reports that even the U.S., you know, the 155-millimeter cannons, ammunition, they're running out of ammunition. They are not producing the ammunition which is required on a daily basis by the Ukrainian army. So from that standpoint, you know, there are skirmishes and things still going on the borders of these of these four provinces. But basically, the West has been destroying its own industrial base, including to produce some of these ammunition, which is not arriving. And therefore, this whole idea that there is a big Ukrainian offensive now, it's somehow a big joke. And I think the attack on the pipeline shows that. From the West, they are really desperate on the underground situation.
And one last question for you. Mr. Varekin, this is an issue that Mr. Bosnich just mentioned moments ago about the purpose of NATO. I want to get your perspective as well. Why did NATO continue to exist following the collapse of the Soviet Union and at the end of the Cold War? What is the purpose of NATO today as we speak?
Well, the purpose of NATO during its creation, as there was one British lawyer who said, was the purpose was to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, which means in Europe, and the Germans down. That was the initial purpose of NATO. Today, I agree with, there was a British professor who said that the only purpose of NATO now is to manage the problems and the conflicts they are creating themselves. So we should put, and with my friend Mr. Cheminade in France, we're calling, and many other candidates have been calling, that France should do like De Gaulle and leave the integrated command of NATO, that we need a new international security order and financial order.
Okay.
That this thing is completely prehistorical barbarism. We should get rid of it.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining us from Belgrade. And Carol Varekin, contributor at the Schiller Institute, speaking to us from the French capital, Paris. And, of course, a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decree.
His decree, though, we learn...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
Ya khaliqa kull shay'in wa waritha.
So, dear listeners, we are talking about how we can gradually increase our ascetic austerity and how this will help to increase, enhance, strengthen, and power up our servitude, our obedience, and our worship to Allah, our ubudiyya. Now, we find, dear friends, that over the course of various programs, we have talked about being considerate to ourselves, meaning we should take ourselves and our conditions on this spiritual path into consideration. When we take this into consideration, then we are able to gauge whether we need to increase our worships in its different various forms, or we need to slow down just a little bit. Now, when it comes to ascetic austerity, of course, asceticism is this idea of living simply, of eating simply, of drinking simply, of having simple clothes. Of course, it is kind of a very detached from the worldly, materialistic aspect of this world. Sometimes this asceticness is translated into other languages as zuhud. Zuhud, of course, meaning asceticism, but it's something that really needs to be explained, and we probably explained it in one of our programs. But very quickly, we need to know that zuhud, this asceticism, this does not necessarily mean that we... you know, take ourselves in the middle of the jungle and sleep on the ground, you know, with barely any clothes and no food, and we don't trim our beard or comb our hair and just kind of live wildly. Like, this is not the meaning of zuhud. So zuhud is actually this detachment of the heart and the soul from materialistic things. Now, this doesn't mean, on the other hand, that we can drive the most expensive car and have the most expensive house and wear the most expensive clothes and eat the most expensive food and then, you know, tell ourselves that, oh, I'm not emotionally attached to any of these things. I'm a zahid. This itself also is wrong. We have to find balance in all of these things. For surely, Islam is the religion of balance. We should have a simple life. Yes, a simple life means good clothes, clean clothes, clothes that are appropriate, you know, a good car, a car that gets us to point from point A to point B. Doesn't necessarily have to be a ultra luxurious expensive car, but at the same time, it doesn't mean that, you know, if you need to travel, for example, 100 kilometers, or you need to travel 100 miles, then you're going to do it on foot because you're an ascetic, or you're going to do it on a donkey, for example, in today's age and time.